You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer. The Democrats scored some big wins in the midterm elections in the United States last week, winning 7 gubernatorial elections, even though 2 races are yet to be called in Florida and Georgia, and gaining 34 seats in the House of Representatives. But what does this mean for higher education funding, a decision that's made at the state level, and the higher education policy that the Trump administration has already tabled? I spoke with our North America editor, Paul Baskin, about what the Democratic victories could mean for higher education in the United States. I also spoke with Eric Fiegel-Ding, a faculty member at Harvard University who ran for Congress in Pennsylvania. But first, here's my conversation with our North America editor, Paul Baskin. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Sarah. Good afternoon.
Yeah, afternoon for me, morning for you. As our the North America editor for Times Higher Education, can you start out by telling us what the lay of the land was for higher education policy, or just the public perception of higher education in general going into the midterms last week?
Sure. Well, perception, actually, there's been some studies out suggesting that the American perception of higher ed is pretty good compared to some other institutions in the country, as compared to things like Congress and, I guess, the media as well. Mm. But generally pretty high. The problem, though, is that the higher education publicly, at least in the United States, is funded largely on the state level, and the amount of state funding into higher education has been declining steadily. In fact, to the point at which the amount of student-paid tuition exceeded the amount of state aid fairly recently, in the last few years. So it's been a pretty steady decline. Public colleges in the United States, which educate the majority of people, there's still obviously a lot of private colleges here in the U.S., but public still do the bulk of the lifting in terms of who gets educated. They're struggling. They're in some pretty severe budget situations.
Hmm. So going into this midterm elections, lots of elections were on the table. We had governor races. We had obviously Congress elections. What were the results? We know that the Democrats won back the House. So maybe you can start there and tell us what sort of impact, if anything, that will have on the higher education sector in the United States.
Right. Okay. Well, obviously, it's, you know, 2 houses in the U.S. Congress. The Republicans still hold the Senate. Democrats, as you said, just took the House. Higher education policy isn't really driven heavily on the federal level. Again, as you mentioned, the funding pretty much comes from the states, and funding is what drives policy. Mm. That said, of course, one of the major ways in which the federal government has an effect on U.S. higher ed is through the student aid program, in which the federal government provides, you know, low-cost loans or grants to students, and because it does that, that gives it the power to dictate some, in fact, quite a few policies on colleges. Now, what will happen as a result of the Democrats having half the Congress? Not clear. I mean, it's sort of the main thing people are talking about, big picture, is that it will make a gridlock situation even further gridlocked.
Mm.
One of the main things that the higher ed wants to get out of the Congress is what they call a reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act. It's sort of a way of saying every few years they like to update the rules that guide colleges. This is what's called the Higher Ed Act.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't done that now in several years. Some of the main things that the colleges like to see get done through that process are some updating of the rules for student aid. You know, every year the Congress decides how much federal student aid to make available, but the rules on how it's divvied up, who's eligible for it, what student groups to target, that needs to be changed every once in a while to match what's out there in terms of need. And not having been done for a while makes the student aid system in the minds of college leaders more difficult to work with, less efficient in terms of getting to the people it's needed. So the question is whether that will be done now under this divided Congress in the next few years. The consensus seems to be not likely. But we could be surprised. I mean, there's certainly been times in the history where we think going in that a government being all in one hands of one party is going to make it smoother for things to pass. And in fact, the opposite happens.
Mm-hmm.
That's very tough to predict.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing you were talking about is in terms of the voting in this past election was a lot around the country. Several states had votes on whether to approve budget money for higher ed.
Mm.
So every one of them passed, which is interesting. I mean, I couldn't really say necessarily was unexpected fully, because one thing to keep in mind is when people are asked directly about supporting higher ed, they tend to be more willing to do that. A lot of the reasons why the budget doesn't get set at the level that people might like it to be is because when it's set by state legislatures, they're obviously looking at other competing priorities, and it's tough to necessarily pull out the money. So if you get to the point where you ask the voters directly for money for college aid, for college aid, at least this has shown that people are more willing to do that. A couple of things to keep in mind there, too. One is that a lot of these votes were actually on education money broadly, not just for higher ed, mm-hmm. but for K-12 level as well. Two is that the amounts of money involved were not the full amount of money that colleges in these public colleges in these states need to operate. In a lot of cases, it was money like for a particular program. Some cases, it was money for building construction. In some cases, it was money for, well, an interesting one actually was in Seattle, a free college program, a so-called free college program. I mean, then we can get into a whole discussion of free college here in the United States and what that means and what that involves, but it's not certainly like you see in other countries in the world where there's sort of a more genuine free college. It's more of a kind of a case where there's conditions and restrictions. Mm. Often it's limited to the first 2 years of college, and it's limited to people of certain income levels, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the fact that it is at a state level, like you said, the way that the funding is decided and where the funding is going and how it's presented to voters is very much different in each state. And tell us about the case in Montana, which is quite a unique way of going about asking the public directly for higher education funding.
Right. They ask the voters every 10 years if they want to approve a certain sum of money. It was, I believe, $200 million this year spread over 10 years. So we're not talking about a huge amount of money. It feels almost like it's more symbolic, but the point is that it did get approved. I mean, I was actually at another conference last week in New York where they were talking about various things on higher ed, and one of the things that came up at that was the question of whether this would be a kind of a model for getting more funding into public schools. If the voters are showing that they're willing to do this, then, well, why not do that more often? I mean, one drawback, of course, is that if they do that, then the legislatures may just reduce the amount of money they give to the colleges otherwise, so it may not result in a net increase. I mean,
right.
We saw that. One of the votes, in fact, this year in Massachusetts, this is again the K-12 level, but it was an issue of the state lottery. The state lottery is all over the country, and they're supposed to go for education, but usually what the result is the legislature, the state, simply reduce the amount of money that they would otherwise give, so it doesn't result in a net gain. So this was a ballot question to try to somehow jigger it so that the money was definitely going there. But getting back to the college level, the question is, could you realistically fund colleges by having a dedicated appropriation the voters agree on a regular interval? That might work. But what some of the colleges are talking about was then, the trade-off might be that the voters then get a lot more specific in terms of real outcomes they want from colleges, in terms of graduation levels, who gets in, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that kind of whole notion hasn't been discussed very much in this country. It might be quite interesting to see what that would lead to in terms of what changes and what directions it would lead U.S. public colleges to do. So I think that the vote this year on that may at least lead to some more discussion of what that kind of model might look like.
Yeah, and I mean, it would certainly increase the public participation with higher education in general. I mean, just thinking about the Pew poll that said 67% of Republicans either doubt or have little confidence in higher education. I imagine if voters are directly participating in how higher education is funded and looking at outcomes, then surely that would help a little bit with public perception.
It would, and it's interesting you mentioned that about the Republicans, and that really feels like a fairly new phenomenon, and it's hard to tell for sure. I mean, what people have always talked about in higher ed is that the partisan divisions that you see in this country on so many things often don't apply in higher ed, and one of the more direct measures of that is another area where the federal government does have a fairly direct hand in colleges, and that's funding for the U.S. agencies that finance research. We're talking about the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation. Those give out billions of dollars a year to universities for research, and those numbers. Those numbers do go up and down at times over the years, depending on a variety of circumstances. But as a general rule, yes, the Democrats tend to be a bit more supportive of it, but the Republicans often, at least historically, have been very supportive as well. Now, this thing that's happening more recently in terms of the public skepticism toward colleges that's being driven largely by Republican voters, at least according to polls such as the one you mentioned, hard to tell how long-standing that is. I mean, a lot of things that are going on in this country right now are sort of, you know, without precedent in a lot of ways. So it's really hard to figure out exactly what it is. But yes, there's a sense that a lot of the academics in this country are overwhelmingly liberal and democratic in terms of their party stances. And that's kind of wearing, it seems like, on some Republicans who are kind of wondering, you know, why they're funding what some of them see as an institute that's, you know, it's in the business of indoctrinating, you know, the young people of this country into liberal perspectives. That's again, we'll have to see where that plays out right now.
Yeah, I also think that if Republicans were polled directly on how do you feel or what confidence you have in X local university that's 30 minutes down the road from you, I have a feeling that their confidence in that would be a bit different.
It is. And so, I mean, that's the case in a lot of things, too. I mean, like, for instance, the whole issue of whether voters have confidence in the U.S. Congress, it's a very negative result you get when you ask that question generically. But when you ask about, you know, but clearly you see that they keep reelecting their own member of Congress over and over again. So,
right.
And yes, very, very much the same thing, as you mentioned, is the case with colleges. I mean, they academia they might not like, but, you know, the university of whatever state they're in, they tend to be very supportive of.
Yeah. Going back to the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives, I know you said that not a lot of legislation will get passed through potentially because of bipartisan gridlocking, but I'm just wondering if there are any key points in Trump administration regulation that Democrats will be focusing on?
Yes. In fact, the Trump administration has already announced that beginning early next year, they're going to start a fairly thorough review of regulations. And the way it works here in this country is Congress passes laws, but the laws don't often set the exact details of what will happen. So you have regulations that the administration is allowed to define. In several areas, one is student loans. So rules on student loan repayment, exactly what it means by when students get some of their student loan money paid for by the federal government in return for doing certain things such as working as a teacher or working in the military, that kind of thing. Those are going to be redefined. There's going to be a look at regulations governing sexual assault issues. There's going to be another big one is accreditation. I mean, so the way it works in the United States is colleges are accredited, you know, by private accrediting agencies, but those accrediting agencies themselves have to be accredited in a sense by the federal government, and the rules by which are set for which the ways they judge the fitness of colleges. Those need to be set. And the reason colleges pay attention to them is because in order for the students to get federal student loan money, they need to be accredited. So that gives the federal government all kinds of power to define how the schools operate. Anyway, one of the key issues it gets to is that there's obviously a big push in the United States to try online education. It's obviously cheaper in a lot of ways for the colleges and for the students. And it allows for new ways of teaching. I mean, one of the classic ways that your eligibility to a college's eligibility to award federal student aid is that you have measures of how long the students sit in the classroom, how many credit hours they take, that kind of thing. And the problem is those kinds of measures don't sync up very well with an online format, especially an online format than some of the newer online formats, which are trying to judge students by their achievements, but their ability to perform certain functions. This whole talk about what they call credentials, which is a way of showing that a student is able to do a certain thing short of actually awarding them a bachelor's degree. That whole world needs to be worked out, and that's one of the key areas that's going to be handled in the regulatory environment. The concern, the colleges are very much interested in this. They want to have the flexibility to do this. There's also the concern of abuses, and sort of we got a lesson on that over the last 10 years from a whole number of private colleges, private for-profit colleges that sprung up in the United States, promising sort of this new version of teaching people en masse with online, and what a lot of them turned out to be was, you know, more or less scams that were aimed at getting, you know, anybody to sign up, get eligible for student aid, take the aid, and then really not educate the student properly. So what the trick in this regulatory process will be is to set some rules that allow allow the flexibility to teach, you know, in different formats, different online formats, but try to make sure that the abuses are limited, if at all. And this is going to be a really tricky thing. I mean, you know, because there's a lot of suspicion that the Trump administration is sort of favorable toward the for-profits. It might make rules that sort of help revive the for-profit industry. So there's a great deal of wariness among the higher ed community on that. At the same time, a great deal of, you know, interest in figuring out a way of making the rules a lot more, you know, a lot more open to experimentation.
Yeah, and it also sounds like it's just an update on them as well to be tailored to and to respond to the changing face of higher education.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's one of the leading actors in this sector is a small college in rural New Hampshire called Southern New Hampshire University. And it decided, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, it was wasn't doing very well in terms of the number of students it had on campus. It was struggling like a lot of small colleges around the United States because they just don't have enough money. And they decided to go very, very big online. They've created a whole new campus without actual students there. That's all about online. They've grown astronomically. They now have more than 100,000 students.
Mm.
And what they promise is an outcomes-based method of teaching and evaluating students. And they say they have a lot more hands-on treatment of the students than in a lot of so-called brick and mortar models, because they can sort of follow the students very closely online in terms of what they're doing, what they're looking at, what they're struggling with, address it directly, and then really measure whether they've succeeded. And they see it as not only a more economically efficient model of operating, but a much better one in terms of ensuring the students really don't fall through the cracks and really are able to succeed in the long run, even if in some cases it may take longer, some cases it may be shorter. The time is not really, matter of fact, that's one of the things they talk about is one of their slogans, the way of referencing is that, you know, what traditional college does is they measure time, whereas what they want to do is measure success and ability and competence. There's a lot of questions as to how to actually set up the rules to allow that kind of model to exist and at the same time prevent it from being exploited by maybe less scrupulous operators.
So that's regulation at the federal level. Let's talk about the state gubernatorial races. There are some big wins starting off in Wisconsin. Is that probably the biggest victory for the higher education sector?
On that level, that's probably fair to say, just because Governor Scott Walker kind of made a name for himself for being kind of hard line in a bunch of areas. Initially, what he got known for was sort of busting unions, not necessarily related to education. But then, yes, he came in and cut the budget of the University of Wisconsin quite sharply and attacked tenure provisions. So he was really seen as kind of a leading edge of what potentially a governor of a particular political persuasion could really do in terms of making it difficult for public universities to operate. Obviously he wouldn't have said it that way. He would talk about it in terms of more efficiencies and things like that. I mean, that sort of gets into a whole set of questions is what the public colleges are really chafing at, which is that as they lose budget support from their states, yet they're still legally considered public colleges. So they're finding themselves in a position of the way one college president described it as allowing a minority stakeholder, an 8% minority stakeholder in some cases, to really dictate the company. Mm. I mean, they said what other company would allow an 8% shareholder to run it? And that's the case in some public colleges here in the U.S. So the Governor Walker lost to a Democrat, and Democrats won several other state houses in the United States in this past election. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think they gained maybe a net of maybe 8 governorships or something like that. So what that will really have in terms of effect on public colleges is yet to be seen. I mean, there was pickups in state legislatures too. That's an important thing to keep in mind as well. I mean, Republicans have really dominated both state legislatures and state governors in the United States, even though they typically don't have the majority support among the voting public in the United States. It's a complicated, explanation of why it has to do with a bunch of factors, including just a greater strategic determination to focus on these as important. And the Democrats seem to be waking up to that a bit and pushing back a bit more. What that will mean in terms of, support for higher ed is to be seen, because even though there may be the political sympathy levels rising for support, there's still, states are constrained by whatever their budget situations are. I mean, North Dakota is a great example. I mean, they got really wealthy on oil a few years ago, and their state university budgets just went skyrocketing. So it wasn't like it wasn't like a lot of, like, states necessarily don't want to fund their universities. It's just that they're allowing themselves a certain amount of money. Economic conditions are what they are, and there's a lot of things to take care of. There's, you know, people's health and basic operations of the state.
Yeah, it's one of many priorities on the list.
Right.
Yeah. The number of young people that voted in this election was also a lot higher than previous midterm elections. Do you think that bodes well for higher education if we're thinking about the people who are benefiting directly from it right now or in favor of it?
It does, but well, I mean, to be seen. I mean, yes, you're right that the number, the percentage of voters of the young age and the way they measure is generally 18 to 29. So it's pretty much the college age population, including maybe getting to graduate levels. And of course, a lot of those people are not college students; they're just people who are that age. But anyway, the rate went up. I think it was, I don't know, in front of, I think it was somewhere in the 20% level to somewhere in the 30%, high 30% level.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the turnout, the nationwide turnout was about 49% in this country. So that's, there's, even though the number of younger voters went up, they're still well below their share in the U.S. population. It's just a tough, you know, it's a tough age to get people out to vote. You will see them obviously a lot more at rallies and protests, but when it comes time to vote, it's maddeningly frustrating to a lot of people, you know, certainly supporters of higher ed who believe this is a voting bloc that will help them, that they just don't show up for the vote. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go on that make that difficult, you know, maybe with some degree of intentionality in this country that make it difficult for people to vote. You know, there's certainly a lot of, you know, evidence that suggests that the Republican Party does well when it's a bit more difficult for people to vote, because generally the people who support that party are older and more, have a bit more means and a bit more ability to overcome, you know, whatever obstacles are put out there. Whereas a younger voter and maybe a poorer voter, if it's not, you know, something they can do fairly easily, or, you know, then they won't vote. And, and we keep seeing that in this country, certainly and especially in some states that are making it especially difficult. The way that it works in the United States is voting is on a Tuesday, and that's that had its roots in the country's agricultural origins, and it may have made sense back, you know, 100 or 200 years ago to do it that way. It just doesn't anymore. A lot of states are doing early voting, which they set up a smaller number of polling places that are open for the entire week before the vote. That helps a lot. This question is, you know, some are going more heavily into mail-in voting, but some are prohibiting that. And there was one district that put a polling place, didn't put a single polling place in the town, and put the polling place, you know, outside the town where you had to drive to. There's a variety of what goes on in this country because the elections are all run on a state by state and in some cases local by local level.
And that was THE's North America editor, Paul Baskin. Eric Fiegel-Dean gave up his faculty position at Harvard School of Public Health to run for Congress in Pennsylvania. He said that there's not enough political advocacy for science-based policy. Here's what he had to say about his decision to run for Congress. Eric, can you start off telling me about how you made the decision to resign from your position at Harvard University to run for Congress in the 10th Congressional District in Pennsylvania?
I think it was a very easy decision. A, first of all, there's science and truth is very much under threat in this Trump administration, and facts are being thrown in the wind, and there's no accountability. And very, very much more than that, science is being threatened, whether it's EPA, whether it's healthcare programs, whether it's nutrition programs, everything we know works, that science tells us works, is basically being ignored. And I couldn't stand by while that happened. So I went into public health. I'm a public health scientist because I wanted to actually save lives. But right now, in this day and age, we can publish all we want, but the science, we can publish it into the wind, into the ether, and hopefully someone will use it. But in this day and age, all that is being ignored. So all of science is being ignored and for partisan gains. So I think it was time that, you know, science fought back. And that's why I stepped to the plate and I took a shot running for Congress in my home district.
So would you say that scientists, especially in this day and age, in this political climate, need to take more action like you do? They need to kind of step out from behind the lab table and become more political?
I think this is something that scientists have to think about deeply, because this is something, as scientists, our work is to improve the state of the world, to make the world a better place, you know, to live. And doing what we do just to publish, write grants without actual accountability of are the policymakers and lawmakers using it to actually improve the world is very troubling. So I think this is something we have to do. I think more scientists need to step up to the plate. And that's why political groups like 314 Action to help get scientists elected have been very, very instrumental and important. But scientists also need to be able to step up to the plate themselves, have the courage to step out of their labs to actually face the public and fight for what is right. Because as scientists, we know what is right, we know is true, and we know how to solve problems.
And how was it whenever you were running? Was it advantageous for you to have this background? Did that resonate with your potential constituents?
I think, especially my public health background, it really resonates, because healthcare is one of the most highly controversial areas this election, and people really cared about their healthcare and not losing healthcare. But also things like the opioid epidemic. Opioid epidemic is ravaging urban, rural, suburban, every single community across the country. And so my public health background really resonated, because I was someone who took on the drug industry. Years ago, I was a whistleblower against Merck in the drug Vioxx, which is a painkiller. And I wanted to take that to fight the opioid epidemic. And also, I'm a nutritionist. I want to make sure people have affordable and quality nutrition and food. And healthcare, fighting for public health and universal healthcare coverage is something I've done. And this is why I think our MedSitch really resonates.
You didn't end up making it past the primary. It was a Lutheran minister named George Scott who ended up being on the Democratic ticket, who eventually lost to Scott Perry, who was the Republican candidate. How do you feel about the outcome?
Well, George is a dear friend, and I supported him after my campaign. Our campaign originally in the primary had 8 candidates, so. I was one of the final 4 that actually made it onto the ballot, and we had a good double-digit showing. This district, though, it does lean very conservative. The number of Republicans equals the number of registered Democrats and independents combined. So it was an uphill climb in that sense. And even our governor, who was up for re-election, he won by 17 points statewide, but he actually lost by 1 point in our district voters. So this is a very conservative-leaning district, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't fight. And there's been, in the blue wave, you know, George got very close, so I was very happy to support him. And I think with a few more years of grassroots campaigning, I think we can retake the district. But that, again, that's not the reason I chose to run. I chose to run because science is under threat, facts are under threat, and healthcare, people's fundamental healthcare and well-being when it comes to things like opioids are under threat. And I feel like having a scientific background and public health background is critically important. And I think there's not enough scientists running and not enough political advocacy on behalf of good science evidence-based policies.
What advice would you give to other scientists who are considering running for political office?
Well, I first of all, build a network beyond your lab, beyond your university or department, because to run a political campaign, you have to have a lot of support from many, many different groups and from scientists and other supporters from across the country. And luckily, we were able to build that in just 10 weeks. We raised $300,000, and we were able to fundraise from scientists and professors and physicians across the country who really, really responded to our message to fight for science to backs in healthcare, and they really appreciated that someone with actual expertise and know-how was running. And this is also why an ocean scientist, oceanographer Joe Cunningham in South Carolina won. He defeated the Republican in a district that he was even more red than mine. So scientists can win in difficult districts, and scientists need to step up. And I think more in this day and age, we need more people with PhDs and MDs than we need lawyers, because there's only 3 members of Congress with a scientific background, but several hundred with a JD business background. So I think fighting for facts and truth, you need that expertise, especially as we confront things like AI, very difficult potential global pandemics, healthcare crisis, opioids. You need someone with actual scientific and public health background.
What about if for example, for scientists, if maybe a life in the public eye isn't necessarily their cup of tea, or if they aren't completely comfortable with that, or frankly, they just don't have the funds or the time to take that up, what else can scientists do to try to promote this cause of getting policy changes?
I think standing up for a lot of these existing scientific groups is really important, but just basically, advocacy alone from a nonprofit perspective only has so much sway in the world of politics, because politics is all about money and the threat of being elected or not getting re-election. So in terms of playing electoral politics, I know oftentimes scientists are shy, but I think scientists need to really organize, just like women's marchers did, just like moms against drunk driving or against gun violence have. We need, as scientists, we need to actually organize and become a political movement to fight against bad science, against bad policies, against things that threaten our livelihood, and actually put political muscle and political capital around that. Whether it's an existing campaign, or we actually lend more credibility to a new scientist-focused campaign. And I think March for Science has demonstrated there's a clear national, international movement for science. And I think organizing that into an actual political movement beyond just marching is something we have to consider.
And that was Eric Fiegelding, a faculty member at Harvard University. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks very much for listening. If you've got any comments or suggestions for the podcast, please do get in touch. Sarah.Custer@TimesHigherEducation.com. And you can find Paul Baskin's coverage in the run-up to the election and the results on TimesHigherEducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.